Welcome to the New Books Network.
You're listening to New Books in Geography, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host for today, Stentor Danielson, from the Department of Geography, Geology, and the Environment at Slippery Rock University. Today, I'll be talking to John Garth, author of The Worlds of J.R.R. Tolkien, published last year by Princeton University Press. Professor Garth, welcome to the show.
Hi, Stentor. Good to talk to you, and thank you for having me.
Okay, to start off, why don't you tell our listeners a bit about your background and how you came to write this book?
Well, the first point is a correction. I'm in no regard a professor, at least not in the British sense. I occasionally teach at university level in the US, so I suppose in that respect, people have called me professor, but it always seems rather strange to me. Anyway, I came to write the book... My background's actually in journalism. I took an English degree, English language and literature, back in the 1980s at Oxford, which set me up pretty well to write criticism and do literary analysis. But it didn't set me up particularly well to study Tolkien. I then learned to write in a different way as a journalist and also to research, which was quite vital. And I came to writing this particular book originally as a result of writing a book called Tolkien and the Great War, which is published in the US by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. And that came out in 2003. And there were sections of that which took me into thinking about the landscapes of the war and how they influence parts of the Lord of the Rings. And I wrote some papers after that book, some conference papers dealing with the dead marshes in the Lord of the Rings. So I was already thinking about this issue of how a real landscape could help to inspire a fantasy landscape. And then in 2015, I began a 9-month period as a fellow of the Black Mountain Institute at the University of Nevada in Las Vegas. And there I was writing another book on Tolkien, but again I found myself repeatedly coming back to particular locales that seemed to me to be touchstones for Tolkien. They seemed to have He seemed to have visited them at key points in his life. They seem to have made key differences to his writing. So following that, I happened to be chatting to an old colleague of mine from the London Evening Standard, which is London's daily newspaper. And I used to work for the Evening Standard. I worked there for 13 years. And my colleague, Victoria Summerlee, now writes books about English gardens. And she just said to me quite casually, "I think that my publisher would really love a book by you on places that inspired Tolkien." And I think she and the publisher were imagining something very much in the coffee table genre, where the pictures are perhaps more important than the text. An easy book to write, and it was quite a sensible suggestion. Since I'm not an academic, I'm a freelance, of course. I have difficulties justifying the time that I want and need to spend on researching Tolkien. So dealing with a topic that I could write on in an efficient and straightforward way using material that I already had in hand seemed like a really good prospect. So I went to the publisher and they were quite excited and I sat down to write it. And of course, it did take me quite a bit longer than I expected, though I had been very optimistic in thinking that I could turn it around in 3 months. It took me about 8. And then there was a period of time when I was working with the publisher on the picture selection and to some extent on the layout of the book. It's a really beautiful book. You've got to see it to believe it. So there we are. Yeah, that was, it's a bit of a complicated story, but that's how I produced the book, and it is actually much richer than I expected. It really it was a complex thing to produce, with many internal interconnections, because of its theme. It's not something that one could tell a biographical story from in chronological order, as I had done with my book Tolkien and the Great War. But I think it's worked out very well. It's going down pretty well. It's just been nominated for a Tolkien Society Award. That's the Tolkien Society of Great Britain. And it's just come out in Germany, where there seem to be daily blog reviews of it saying what a wonderful book it is. So that's very gratifying.
Yeah, and I can agree about when you said the illustrations are very important. It's a very richly illustrated book. You've got modern photos of some of the places you're talking about. You've got historical photos. You've got a bunch of Tolkien's own illustrations that he did. You've got some maps and diagrams that were produced for the book. So actually, since that topic has come up, could you tell us a bit about what was the process like in finding and selecting all of those illustrations?
Well, first of all, yes, I wanted quite specifically to use images that of the world as Tolkien would have seen it. So contemporary photography, images by fellow artists working at the time Tolkien was alive, to help give a flavour of a whole culture. Tolkien as part of a whole culture, not as some oddity separate from it. I wanted to include maps that would help people understand what was where, and therefore contemporary maps of the world as it was at that time, because it has changed quite a lot in the last 100 years, particularly the area around the West Midlands English city of Birmingham, which has grown enormously since Tolkien lived in a little village on the outskirts. And that little village now no longer exists because it's completely covered over by suburban housing. So the process was, one other feature, the publisher was very, very keen to get the agreement of the Tolkien estate to use some of Tolkien's own artwork in there. And that seemed to me to be a fine idea too, because it shows Tolkien's vision. And my research into his creative processes is all about Tolkien's vision. The publisher, when I'd finished writing the book, asked me to nominate some points from each chapter that would make potentially good visual material. So I sent them a list. They set their picture researcher to work on that. Picture researcher sent back a set of images to me, and I went through them, and I said, no, this doesn't work. This is great. And we worked that way. It was like a tennis match. It was bouncing ideas backwards and forwards. And I did a fair bit of the picture research myself in the end because, well, clearly I knew more about the subject than the picture researcher possibly could. And I thoroughly enjoy it too. I used to lay out news pages for newspapers. So this was kind of harking back to that time for me.
Okay. So I read this book because I'm a major Tolkien fan, but I asked you to come on this show because I think that this is a book that would be of interest to people who care about geography and landscape, even if they're more casual readers of Tolkien. So could you talk a bit about how you saw the audience for this book and who you think would benefit from reading it?
I'm always sort of poised between wanting to appeal to people who are, you know, deeply knowledgeable and deeply interested in a topic, and also to the general reader. And I think this comes from my journalistic background. So at the Evening Standard, I would often be handed quite complex science stories written by the science correspondent, and I would have to edit them. I was there as an editor rather than a writer, edit them for public consumption, and make those complex ideas, not dumb them down, but clarify them. So the aim, the book is simply aimed at anyone who's interested. And I do think that, well, first of all, it really ought to hit the spot with the dedicated and curious Tolkien fan, of which there are many, many, hundreds of thousands or perhaps millions across the world, because Tolkien encourages curiosity. He makes you look at the real world around you. That's why there are so many people who think they've walked into some scene that must have inspired Tolkien. You know, there are places around the world where people have said, oh, Tolkien must have been here because it's so much like Middle Earth, you know. And then again, there is, as you say, a wider kind of cultural relevance to this, which is, and I think this is, you can see this in books that are being published now about literature and art, certainly in Britain, I imagine in the US as well, there is a growing interest in the way we as human beings respond to our environment through literature and art, how that reflects our attitudes to our own habitat, how our habitat shapes us. So this is, I think, part of that wider literary or artistic or cultural conversation.
And I think I could use my own career as kind of an illustration of the points you're making there, because I started studying geography because of Tolkien, that the seeing the worlds that he put together got me interested in these kind of topics. And I think this book does a good job of illustrating that dimension to his work and to the landscapes that he was living in. So now I want to kind of turn and talk about some of the content of the book, give people sort of a taste of some of the things that they'll get from reading it. So to start off with, so Tolkien famously said in one of his letters that he began his writing with the ambition to write, quote, a mythology for England. So could you explain what he meant by that and to what extent that's a helpful framework for understanding his writing?
Britain did and does have the Arthurian stories, but Tolkien felt that they had their shortcomings. First of all, their origin is Celtic rather than English. So you know, Tolkien was fascinated by Anglo-Saxon culture, the culture of the Germanic people who arrived shortly after the retreat of the Roman Empire from Britain. And he also, I think, wanted to imagine a mythology for England that included a pantheon and all those things that he saw in the Greek and the Roman mythologies. These were templates for him. And that's what he tried to start building right in the First World War, in fact. And in my first book, Tolkien and the Great War, I try to express the many complex ways in which the timing of that is important. But quite clearly, when you are a nation fighting perhaps for survival, you are going to be very interested in what you're fighting for. And I think that building of an English mythology was one of those, was a project that Tolkien pursued partly for that reason.
Okay, so in the book, you get into some really fine-grained geographical research at times, linking certain places and ideas in Middle Earth to specific places in the real world that Tolkien visited or experienced. So you talk about things like his hiking trip that he took in the Alps and how that connects to certain places in Middle Earth. You talk about the specific patch of woods where he watched his wife Edith dance that became the inspiration for the Beren and Luthien story. So I was wondering if you could pick out one example like that and kind of talk us through the basics of how you made that connection between Tolkien's works and a specific location to give us kind of a flavor of some of the research that goes into this book.
Well, let's take the Beren and Lúthien example, since you mentioned that, and it's a relatively straightforward one. The story is perhaps one that people are not familiar with if they haven't read the Silmarillion. It is mentioned in The Lord of the Rings, where the hobbits are with Aragorn, Strider, on Weathertop, and he sings a song about Beren and Lúthien, how this mortal warrior, Beren, sees an elf princess dancing in a fairy wood, and they fall in love. And this is an impossible love because she's immortal and he's mortal, but somehow they overcome these things together. This is a story Tolkien wrote in 1917, and in a late letter he wrote shortly after the death of his wife Edith, he told his son Christopher, she, Edith, was my Lúthien. She danced for me in a small wood, and that was the inspiration for that story. And it was when I was with the Lancashire Fusiliers, an army battalion, in Yorkshire during the First World War. So that those were the clues I had. And this story was so important to Tolkien that he had the name Lúthien carved on his wife's gravestone. And now that he is buried with her, the name Beren is also on that tombstone. And this is one of those things where you do see, you know, you can quite clearly see that he's for an artist who's very, very wary about talking of his inspirations or stating autobiographical intent, he has done so there quite definitively. So I went to that area of Yorkshire in which he was with the Lancashire Fusiliers in 1917. He had fought in the Battle of the Somme the previous year in northern France, and he'd fallen sick there with something called trench fever, and he'd been brought home on a hospital ship, and he'd spent time in hospitals and convalescing, and then he'd been sent to Yorkshire to join this battalion that was training new recruits and helping to guard the coast of Britain against possible attack across the North Sea from Germany. And I knew the name of the camp, the army camp at which he had been based. And I visited that, although there's nothing left of it now. And I knew the name of the little village, Roos, near which he said that this wood in which Edith had danced stood. And I had modern maps, detailed modern ordnance survey maps, that's the official map maker in Britain, as well as photocopies of ordnance survey maps from his era. And there were actually very, very few woods in the landscape now or then. It's a very flat and rather dull landscape apart from these woodlands. But there is one right next to the church, in fact, at the southern end of this village. And the key point about it is that, like the wood that Tolkien describes in his reminiscence and in his story, every year this wood grows a glorious crop of a flower called cow parsley, which he calls by its colloquial name, which is hemlock. Hemlock, in this case, being nothing to do with the poison belladonna or the hemlock pine, the tree, which is native to North America, but not to Britain. So this flower looks like a white umbrella of florets, of tiny flowers. And they grow in such profusion that when you look at it, it looks like you're looking at a sea of froth. And it would have made an intensely bright and memorable backdrop to this wonderful dance that Edith Tolkien did at a time when Tolkien was still recovering from the horrors and shocks of the Battle of the Somme and of losing two of his three closest friends in that battle. We still don't know definitively whether that is the wood in question. And I suppose there's always a possibility that some other information will come to light that will prove or disprove my case. But like everything else, I've put it to the test of likelihood. I've looked at other options and nothing seems to fit the bill apart from this one wood.
Okay, so then the flip side to something like that is that you also have to debunk sometimes claims that people make that a certain place was what inspired a certain thing in Tolkien. And so that kind of raises the question of why do you think people are so eager to tie places to Tolkien, to want to say this was the place that inspired this or that in Tolkien?
I think there are two reasons, and one is really positive and understandable, and this is the one I've talked about earlier, which is that, you know, when you're a devoted wanderer in Middle-earth, you do see parallels with places in the real world that you visit, particularly places of striking natural beauty or places of devastation. Because Tolkien describes both those extremes so powerfully and vividly and memorably. And because when you're reading his books, you feel as though you're walking through his world. The upshot of that, as I said earlier, is that people reason that if Tolkien had visited this place too, or if there's a chance he had visited this place, then surely it must have inspired something in Middle-earth. Now, this kind of instinct, positive as it is, then gets picked up upon by publicists, people who are trying to boost visitors to the pub they own, the hotel they run, the area for which they work on the tourist board, that kind of thing. And they are the people who tend to contact newspapers and say, hey, look, we've got this area that, you know, that inspired Tolkien, inspired the whole Lord of the Rings. It is said that he wrote most of the book in the back room of a pub here, whatever, you know, things like that. And the newspaper journalist, not being an expert in Tolkien or his biography, takes that in good faith and reproduces it. And then, unfortunately, you get into a cyclical situation where the newspaper is cited on Wikipedia, and other newspapers or other media outlets look at Wikipedia and they take the information from there, and it's a kind of, what's the word for this, it's sort of self-confirmatory bias which has no or little truth in it, and this applies, I think, to areas of Ireland and Lancashire in the north of England, which, yes, Tolkien visited, but he visited them too late for that to have influenced the writing of The Lord of the Rings, which is, you know, of course, you can't be inspired prospectively by something you haven't yet visited, or not in the same way anyway.
Okay. So some of the connections you discuss in the book, like his boyhood home in Saarhol or the trenches of World War I, are pretty well known. You know, we know that those are definitely places that inspired Tolkien. But some of the other places that you talk about in the book are more obscure. They're not as well known. So what would you say is the most surprising link that you found between a particular place and something in Tolkien's work?
This is where it gets slightly more complicated, because the reason why it's surprising is probably because the route between the place, the real place, and the imaginary place is slightly more complex. So there is a tower near Oxford called Farringdon Folly. And this has never been on the Tolkien map, the Tolkien fandom map. No one had thought about it. Probably most people hadn't heard of it before. In fact, quite frankly, I hadn't heard of it before, and I used to live in Oxford. The reason I think it inspired Tolkien is because in 1936, Tolkien gave a famous and very important lecture about the Anglo-Saxon poem Beowulf. This is the major piece of Old English literature, which everyone studies now. If you study Old English literature at all, you're bound to study Beowulf. And in 1936, when Tolkien gave his talk, he was deeply frustrated by the way this poem, this fabulous, heroic poem, full of tragedy and heroism and beauty, had been treated not as a work of art, a work of literature, but as a source for historical inquiry or archaeology. You know, all things that were valuable in themselves, but the people pursuing them really were just exploiting the poem for something which was not its core, not its core purpose. Its core purpose was to be a work of art. So Tolkien came up with what he called a little allegory to explain this situation. And in his allegory, he turned the Beowulf poet into a man who built a tower. And the critics are his neighbours. And they don't understand why he's built the tower. And they knock it over so that they can look at the old stones from which that tower was originally built. And Tolkien wrote this lecture and used this allegory just at the time when this tower, Farringdon Folly, had been built. It was built in the year earlier, 1935, and it was built against noisy opposition from its neighbours who did not understand what the purpose of it was. You know, there were council committee meetings where these kinds of criticisms were made. What the hell is this for? And one of the responses was, well, it's for a great view. And the allegory, Tolkien's allegory in the Beowulf lecture, ends with Tolkien saying, but from the top of that tower, the man could see the sea. Now, you can't see the sea from Farringdon Folly, but you can see a wonderfully long way. And it seems clear to me that that went into the Beowulf lecture. And then beyond that, you can see that Tolkien took his allegorical towers with its tower with its wonderful view of the sea and planted it in the Lord of the Rings, because there are towers to the west of the Shire from which the elves or the Numenorean men of old could see the sea. And there, amusingly enough, it's the hobbits who are the neighbours who don't understand what these towers are for. So the pattern passes over from Farringdon Folly into this academic lecture and then into the Lord of the Rings. As I say, the route is somewhat complicated, but nonetheless, each step of the way is demonstrably very, very reasonable. And I'm completely convinced that Farringdon Folly was a key point for Tolkien.
All right, so the book is full of interesting elements and nuggets like that. So I encourage all of our listeners here to check it out if this interests you. So I'd like to now wrap up our conversation by asking what you're working on next. What kind of projects are you taking up now that this book is out?
I'm back to working on the book that I began in Las Vegas when I was a fellow of the Black Mountain Institute. It is tentatively called Tolkien's Mirror, and it's about how his creative writings developed against the backdrop of the crises of the 20th century. So it revisits the First World War influence, which I talked about in Tolkien and the Great War, because I've got a lot more to say about that, particularly as that relates to what he wrote later. Tolkien and the Great War doesn't deal with the Lord of the Rings, for example, or the Hobbit. So there's a great deal more to say.
Okay, well, we'll look forward to that book when it comes out. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So you just heard a conversation with John Garth, author of Worlds of J.R.R. Tolkien, published last year by Princeton University Press.